Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Courtney here with a special offer just for you. My new book is coming out in April. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It's all about grief and sorrow and the ways that birds and birding can bring us to a place of hope. It's a book of faith. It's a book of humor. We would love to give you a 20% discount. You can use this code, IVPPOD20. That's IVPPOD20. That code will give you 20% off and free shipping anywhere in the U.S. when you order from ivpress.com. Pick up your copy of Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief today. Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis. Delighted to have with us today, Stu McClay Smith. Stu is a former corporate executive. He's a member of the Screen Actors Guild. I want to learn more about that in a moment. And he's a professional photographer. His cardinal photos bring me so much joy. You can find his photos on X and on his website. We'll link to both in the show notes. Welcome, Stu.
Well, thank you, Courtney. I've been looking forward to this.
Thanks for being here. And thank you for all the cardinal photos.
Oh, sure. I just love them. I don't, you know, and it isn't like I attach a huge significance to a cardinal over anything else. I just find they have, just stunningly beautiful. People always kind of gravitate toward the males because they're the bright red, but I find just as much, maybe even more beauty in the females because they're all so different. And when you get up really close with a camera and you get a good look at them, you see how many different colors really are present in the female cardinal. So I'm just fascinated by them. And they have lots of personality, which I try to capture.
They do. You do such a good job in your photography. And I want to talk more about the craft of photography. I'm not a photographer. I walk around with my iPhone and think I know what I'm doing. But you capture expression and you capture comedy and you capture attitude in these tiny birds that, you know, they don't have the same sort of facial muscles we do to make those expressions. What do you look for when you're snapping a photo?
Well, aside from some of the technical things, which we can cover later on, but that's pretty much good light, having the right gear and the right lens for the shot. But what I look for is just that and an expression. And I think that's the beauty of still photography over video. Video gets a lot more engagement online, but it just kind of mimics what I see when I look outside. Photography is just a frozen second in time. And it allows you to just really take in the image and ponder what it is that you're looking at. Video, your brain moves with the frames. And with stills, you get to absolutely just kind of zero in and consider what it is that you're looking at. So that's kind of where photography for me became magical, was as I was seeing, and I kind of use this as my tagline in photography. I like to show ordinary things in extraordinary ways. And I think birds are great for that because we see these, and you have cardinals where you live or not, any birds you look at, you see them all the time, but you never really see them. But then when you have something like a feeder on your deck or you have somewhere with a lot of birds, you watch them interact. They all have unique personalities. They interact with each other in different ways. The blue jays, you know, interact with the woodpeckers in one way, and the cardinals interact with the sparrows in another way, and there's a pecking order, you know, no pun intended, you know, around the feeder. And it's fun to watch. I was watching this, and as I started taking photos, I started to maybe guess what was really going on in their mind, and that's why I love putting some captions to some of my photos, because I do find them hilarious.
They are. They have so much personality. And you're there in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm here in Southern California. We don't have cardinals. So I appreciate you being my source for all things cardinals. And you're right. The females are so beautiful. And the males get a lot of the attention, but there's this subtle beauty to the shades of their feathers that I didn't really notice or appreciate until your photos started showing up on my feed. So thank you.
Well, and those colors also change during time of year, both the males and the females, and of course, how old they are. The males, interestingly, their color changes through the year based on their diet. So when they're eating a lot of berries and food rich in, I'm going to butcher the word here, but basically keratin, whatever the word is, that gives them a nice bright color. And it's thought that the females are more attracted to the brighter red birds because presumably they are eating a diet which will be more beneficial to them and the young. So that's all. I don't know how they came up with this amongst the ornithologists of the world, but I guess there's got to be some basic in fact, you know, basis in fact in that. It makes sense to me.
It's like being attracted to the bright red sports car, right?
Yeah, same thing. Yeah, sort of. I don't know what that is. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I guess.
Tell us how you got started in photography. I understand you started pretty young.
Yeah, I was my father was a professional photographer, not for his whole life, but certainly during the time when I was, you know, from say age 12 on. And so I got my start just lugging his gear around. And he gave me an old Kodak Retina 2, fully manual, not even a light meter in it. So I had a light meter around my neck and this fully manual 35 millimeter. And my dad would do contact sheets for me, which is basically just nothing more than little tiny pictures of your negatives on a sheet of paper. And everyone that was exposed correctly, and ultimately we got into composition, but if something was composed and exposed correctly, he'd give me a quarter. And then I had saved the quarters to buy another roll of film. And you had to be good because those days you got 24 pictures on a roll of film. So I had to try to get, you know, 15, 20 quarters out of that to buy another roll of film to do it again. So that's how he taught me. I took my first collegiate photography class when I was in between 8th and 9th grade. I got accepted into a program locally where I lived in Florida. And it's just always been part of me. My first professional photography job was in college taking party pictures at fraternity and sorority parties, which was a lot of great stories related to that. Then I got away from it. As I entered the corporate world, went corporate high tech for about 20 years. And during that time, I mean, all I really knew is my soccer pictures were a lot better than the other dad's soccer pictures. So I guess I still had an eye. And then once I moved back to Ohio, went through some things and got sober. And one of the things I did in sobriety was try to find a way to quiet the mind a little bit. And for me to do that was to get into the woods. And that kind of spurred me to pick up my photography again. And it just became, it just became a thing. It's where I find, you know, I kind of connect to the universe when I have my camera and out amongst nature.
I've heard from many folks that birding has been part of their sobriety journey, that there was something about giving up substances and walking away that they needed to find that inner peace, and birds helped them do that.
Well, you have to get out of your own head. That's one of the big, one things that a lot of people with substance issues or alcohol issues in their life have a thing is just this constantly running movie in your head. And you have to get out of your head and into something else. And nature is a great way to do that. And one of the big differences really between, I would say, birding as it's known and bird photography is birding is more of a social, in a lot of ways of, you know, you'll see big group of birders with their binoculars out writing their notes and doing that, where bird photography, what I noticed, it's a lot more of a solo endeavor. Just because, you know, to get shots, we'll talk field craft a little bit, but anyway, and also I prefer it just because when I'm out into that space, you know, I'm not up for a lot of conversation. For me, I'm just taking it all in and you have to be so present, mm-hmm. you know, in that environment, because you hear everything, you're looking, you're watching, and the longer you do it, the more you kind of pick up the cues. Mm-hmm. And to know what makes a good photograph, you know, setting up for good light, setting up for a good perchy location, all those things kind of go into it. And for me, you know, hours go by doing it. And I don't really care if I come home without a single good picture. It's just being out there is the part I enjoy most.
One of my favorite things as a birder, and I'm a very solitary birder, I need my introvert time. I go out alone, is when I'll pass a photographer, a bird photographer on the trail, and I'll, you know, just kind of whisper, do you have a shot to show me? And sometimes they're deep in their craft and they don't want to, but about half the time they're so delighted. And then we get to have this lovely interaction about the common yellow throat that they found, or the, you know, it's a gift to both of us, I think, when I stumble upon them.
Absolutely. I experience that too, where I see people and they'll kind of mutter, you know, seen anything good today?
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of point what you've seen. And I have a steady place I go and other people down there, and they know the park. And so we kind of go through what we've seen that day. But more interestingly, I have a little more public place that I walk just because it's right out my back door. And there they see my big camera, and this thing is a beast. And I've had people go, what on earth do you take pictures of down here? And I start rolling through all the things I see. I see owls. I see hawks. Really? Yeah, there's that stuff around here? And I'll just whip out in the back of my camera or things on my phone and show them photos that I've taken right there. And it's opened other people's eyes to what's out there. They just had no idea that this variety of wildlife, not only birds, but, you know, foxes and coyotes and deer and things like that are literally, you know, right outside their doors. And so hopefully, you know, those people get a whole new appreciation for what's around them. So
it's amazing how much is there once you learn to look and once you learn to notice, and how much escapes you if you're not paying attention. This whole world.
Exactly. I have a people don't believe me when I tell them that I've got these red-shouldered hawks that just are in my backyard all the time. I'm like, really? No, I actually have a picture, and it's kind of funny because it's one of my favorite photos of all time. It's not one anyone would put on their wall, but it's a red-shouldered hawk flying through my backyard, and I've got him in mid-flight. His eye and in his talons is a snake. And it's from this is the difference between photographers and, you know, as a photographers, I'll look at that and go, wow, that's an amazing shot. You know, but nobody would ever want to buy it. And so there's this difference you get into between what's commercial photography and what other photographers. And I learned a long time ago to stop getting, and this is why I post more on X now, is because I used to be on other forums that were all photographers. And photographers look at each other's pictures and they cheer and go whoop whoop for things that nobody would ever buy. Well, on X, I've really found that people are really enamored with songbirds. And photographers poo-poo those things all the time. Oh, they're just backyard birds. But that's what people truly enjoy. And not that I do this for what other people enjoy, but it's really taught me a lot. Get your feedback from consumers of what you do and not necessarily people who are engaged in exactly the same craft you're in.
That's really interesting. I'm sure that the average X Twitter user, I can't call it X, it just drives me crazy.
I know.
The average X user.
I know. I feel like I should have a beanie with a propeller on top.
The average social media user, let's just say, would never notice something. Like, you would notice, oh, it's a tiny bit blurry in that corner, or oh, the light was off a little bit, or I used the wrong exposure. And folks on social media are just saying, I love cardinals, and that's a beautiful cardinal shot, or what an interesting hawk. And we can learn from both, right? When I go to a high school band concert with my husband, he has a great time because he doesn't have a musical background. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh, they're not in tune. Oh, they're off the beat. You know, like, it's painful for me, and I'm trying to be a good sport. But there's something about being an expert that heightens your joy in certain areas, but also can strip away just that normal joy that the average person has in seeing a photo.
Well, one of the things you have to do is adjust to social media, because what makes a good photograph from a classical photography point of view doesn't necessarily work well and social media. One, you have to realize that the vast majority of your work is consumed on screens this big. Okay. Not even on a print size. Forget the big monitor you have at home. Nobody ever scrolls. You know I rarely scroll social media on my full size screen. I'm always on my phone, maybe an iPad. So you have to realize that's how it's consumed. And the other thing too is it's consumed vertically. Okay, where we were all taught, you know, photography, especially landscape photography, is all horizontal. And so all these, you have to make these adjustments. And one of the also things that they used to always tell you about bird photography when I was learning was, is give the subject room to breathe. So don't just put the, but there's no room on a screen this big to add all this space or to do these interesting crops where the, maybe your subject's off to the side looking to the other edge of the frame. That all works great on your screen. It does not, you know, on your big computer screen or on a print. I'll get to prints in a minute, but on social media, if you're doing it for those reasons, you have to just learn how to adjust to the medium where your work is being viewed. And that's been a big adjustment for me because I'm kind of a classical photographer with the rule of thirds and things like that. And so, so I've had to do that. I still don't believe a photo is really a photo until it's been printed.
And so, say more about that.
Well, I really think that even I get lazy just looking at my work, you know, on the screen. And then when someone asks me to do a print for them, I'll print it for them. I'll look at it and I'll go, now that is really remarkable. Because I think part of the problem with screens is that we flip, 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 right? We don't stop. And if somebody hands you a print or you see something that's on a wall and it's stationary and you can't just swipe it away, you're going to take it in a little bit more. And I always have a series of my latest prints out on my dining room table. I haven't had a meal there in years, but it's covered. And I just walk by them and just and I'll just stand there and I'll just look at them. Yeah, that's a – and printing is also from a – if you do your own prints, that's another thing. So you develop – I work my photos a couple of different ways, one for the screen and then one if I print it. And a lot of times I'll save it as a raw image when I do it and then do it two different ways depending on where it's going to be, where it's going to go. So, but I still enjoy prints. People don't understand how much they miss them until you show them one.
It's really true. There's something about it being real in a way that it's not when it's this digital ephemera.
Yeah, no, I agree, and a lot of other people agree with that too. And I'm amazed how many photographers I know don't even have a photo printer.
Wow, yeah.
And so I said, there's a whole other world out there for you.
Yeah, yeah, you got to level up.
Right. Well, yeah, I grew up with a dark room in the basement, so yeah, I was always, you know, at the enlarger doing prints.
Well, walk us through some basics of the craft. If someone's thinking, I want to get started in bird photography, or I'm pretty new to bird photography, where should they start?
Well, the first thing to start is when you is I hate to turn into a gear discussion. We won't go deep into it, but you're going to want to get a lens that's going to give you some reach, because the difficult thing about birds is getting close. And they're never anywhere for very long. So the fact that you think you're going to walk up on one and he's still going to be there by the time you get the camera up. So you're going to want to get a lens with some amount of reach. And you can find, you can go, gosh, you can spend $20,000 on one of these lenses, or you can do something significantly less. But something that's just longer than your average reach, I would say 300 millimeters being pretty much, you know, the minimum. You're going to want a camera with a fast shutter speed, because birds do everything in a very, you know, furtive way. You know, they're just even when they're standing still, their heads are moving fast. So to get a good, clean, sharp image of a bird, you're going to want something that's going to have a fast shutter speed, say at least 1/2000th of a second. If you're going to try to catch birds in flight, that's a topic for another day. That is just trial and error. I have thousands of frames with just a tail in it or blurry.
A very nice cloud.
Putting a bird in a frame is a whole nother topic. But one thing that you can learn to do, and it's the same for birders, I think, with binoculars, is just go out into your yard or wherever you are and find a branch or something and learn how to raise the camera to that and find that in your viewfinder right away. It's like picking up your binoculars. Sometimes there's a lot, you get disoriented when you go from this to magnification. And the other thing I do before I raise, I look at one particular thing that I know I can find. I pick that up and know that's close to what I'm looking for. Just get fast with, you know, from your eyes to whatever you're looking through and make sure you can find it right away. There's nothing more frustrating than wandering. You're never going to find something doing this. You know, it's just impossible. Last thing, and probably I think the most important thing, is light. If I'm walking down a path and I have this beautiful place that I go birding, and the best birding is late in the day or early in the day, mostly early. But early, the sun's going to be low, and it's going to be to one side or the other, or into it or at your back. If I'm walking down a path and I see birds that are into the sun, I'll look at them, but I'm not even going to bother to try to take a photo of them. The best photo is going to be with the sun behind you or quartering to you. So just set up where the light is shining like a, you know, like a flashlight onto the areas you want to do, because sunlight is what really makes the colors in the bird pop. It brings out all the detail, not nearly as many artifacts or whatever in the photo. Where if you're out birding, you'll look anywhere you hear or whatever. But with the photography, really take into account light. I think for a lot of people to get started, if they want, you can set up, if you have a feeder, you set up on a deck or on a railing outside your house that's within access of a window. Clean that window. You can't. But I do this. I put a stupid tarp over my head so they can't see me moving, and I stick my camera on a tripod, and I can take pictures out my window. Just flurry of activity on the deck that's surrounded, because the feeder's there, but they're all queuing up and interacting right outside my window, and you don't need a big long lens to go get that. That's right outside your window. But that's also for people who can't get out or don't have access to something out of way, or access to the right kinds, you know, of equipment. That's something you can really do at home. Is do that. I think, you know, and also don't beat yourself up if you don't get great pictures. I mean, even as long as I've been doing this and is expert or whatever I've become, I can go out in a day and shoot 300 photos. And if I've got three keepers, it was a good day. So just know, and with digital, who cares? Now, with film, that would be a very expensive hit rate. But right. in digital, just go out and keep shooting. Something good's bound to happen.
That's a good word. And I think for a lot of bird photographers who are just starting out, it's the joy of the thing, right? Like they want a picture of whatever bird they love for their wall, or whatever bird their mom loves for her wall. And there's this balance between, if you're really going to go for it, if you want to be a Stu McClay, like, this is going to take a lot of time and effort and learning. But there's also that entry level, like, just for the fun of it, you can get started, and both are a good.
I remember my first good bird photos. It was my friends who went crazy over them. And I was like, you have that feeling, like, I can't believe that. I can't believe I took that. You know, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. And I probably have on my Dropbox, I think I have 2,500 and something saved cardinal photos. And I know I haven't taken my best one yet.
So I usually ask people what their favorite bird is, but I suspect I might know for you, but I might be wrong. What's your favorite bird, Stu?
Well, I think there's a couple. Well, in the songbird category, cardinals, blue jays, but cardinals are just, I have so many opportunities for them. So it's got to be cardinals on the songbirds. I'm also just fascinated by all the raptors. I think the hawks and the kestrels and bald eagles. I'm addicted to a bald eagle live cam that I watch. It's actually Big Bear Valley.
Yeah, that's right up the road from us.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a website, there's a YouTube channel called Friends of Big Bear Valley, and they have a live cam on Eagle Nest up there. And I've been watching it for a few years, and every year last year they struck out because they had a very cold winter.
There was drama last year. Weather and the nest.
Yeah,
and
right. But that's a good one. There's ones in South Florida, but I just fascinated by And also the fact that over the course of my lifetime, the story behind the bald eagle is such a good one. When I was a teenager, I was heard that all the bald eagles were going to die and they were going to go extinct. We had pesticides that were being used. We had farming practices and logging practices that were destroying them. And it's amazing what we can do when we all come together. That there was basically the world, the country pulled together and said, no, we're not going to let this happen. Mm-hmm. And we built the habitats and we protected them and wherever else. So now I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I've got bald eagles around here, you know. And so when we put our minds to something and decide this is really important to us and we're going to do this, they're pretty amazing.
We should do that more often.
If we disagree on anything, it would be good.
Right? I always say birds are the great unifier. Like, they no are. One hates birds. Some people are indifferent to birds or they don't notice birds, but nobody hates birds. You know, they're a wonderful opportunity to come together. And that's one of the things I love about hosting this podcast is we have people from all different walks of life and people from all different faith backgrounds and non-faith backgrounds and education levels and race and age and gender. And birds are the great unifier, you know?
They are. They are.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Stu, where are you finding hope these days? I'm excited for your cat shelter story. You mentioned you got a good cat shelter story for us.
Well, you just gave me a great segue into this. And that is that I volunteered at a cat shelter. And I have a soft spot for cats, always have. I don't, it's just something you have or you don't. But so I volunteered, it's right down the street. And, I found myself spending a lot of time with people who couldn't be any more different than I am. From socioeconomic to race to sexuality to politics to whatever else. But boy, do we rally when it comes to something that just can't care for itself, you know, and or survive on its own. You know, in the world. And all that's forgotten. I mean, these are people who would probably look at me and go, you know, I don't know how many names they would call me if they saw, you know, they would assume they don't like me before we even speak. But because we're there and we're in something where collectively we're doing, you know, something that we're getting something fulfilling out of. And so I was very moved by that, and you know, when I got involved in that, and it's collaborative because one person can't do it all. Everyone has a role in the shelter, from the doctors to the, you know, to the guys like me who clean cat boxes. You know,
labor of love, Stu.
To all the things, to the people who drive the adoption process and bring the adoptees in and the advertise. So anyway, it's all this collective process for just these little creatures who just want nothing more than they just want a home to go to, and they want someone to take care of them. And I think it's just a broader. I think that if you can take that and you can apply it to a broader scale, you know, I think all of us can rally to. We know that there are those amongst us who really don't have the means to look out for themselves. I think we collectively need to, rally, you know, to them. Not assume that everybody's gaming the system who's got a handout. And it's just one of those things that you get kind of caught up and, you know, in the world and your tunnel and the way you lived it and the way you were raised and the way, you know, the direction you see yourself going. There are a lot of good people who are, you know, going, you know, they're not necessarily going the wrong way. They're just going they're just taking a different path. They've come from a different place. But I think that I find hope in that. And then, believe it or not, I find a lot of hope. I've been really studying or just fascinated. It started with the Hubble Space Telescope, and now it's with this James Webb thing. And just when you can take into account the universe and what that really is, and to see things and to be able to look back in time and you realize how perfect it is. No human being could have ever conceptualized what this is. And with that, that leads you to believe in God, and it leads you to believe in a higher power of any kind. You know, I'm kind of, you know, non-denominational when it comes to, I could look at a plant and just go, you know what? I couldn't have built that. So it ain't me. And I know, I don't know what the center of the universe is, but it's not me. And I think that that's kind of really is as specific as I really need to get with myself to have what I'll call faith. I was raised in the Episcopal Church. My father was agnostic. I don't think I saw my father in a church until I got married. I think it was the very first time I'd ever seen him in the church. So, but anyway, so it's a little different household as far as that goes. And I've pretty much, I've been involved in a non-denominational church here and one in Texas, but I'm pretty much more of a, you know, looking at, you know, just kind of more of the overall universe, my part in it, and pretty much just focused on, I think when you come across somebody when you pass somebody on the street or have an interaction with them, you can either be a positive impact on their day or a negative. You can gain energy from the exchange or you can lose energy from the exchange. And I just try to keep my spirituality kind of in those bounds. And seems to be working for me.
I'm glad your dad didn't miss your wedding.
He threatened.
We're going to need to take this outside.
Sure. Yeah.
So yeah. Stu, we're heading into spring. I know it doesn't seem like that. We're kind of in the February is the worst month in the Midwest. I remember it's just relentless. But as you think about spring and the season of migration, what are you looking forward to? You're in that great Mississippi Flyway area. You must get so many migrants coming through in Ohio. What are you looking forward to?
Oh, we do. And we get a combination, and we get the ones that just are passing through. So they fly through and then they go. So we get to see them for about a week or 10 days. And those are the ones that I get most excited about. And then of course we get some of the ones that are here for the summer who show up and stick around for a while. Hummingbirds being one of those, the others being the Baltimore Orioles. And then we get sandhill cranes and things that pass through, and there's nowhere here for a sandhill crane. They're on the way to Canada, you know, to the big wetlands up there. So it's all very exciting. That's the good news. The bad news is the leaves come back onto the trees and everything gets harder to see. And by July, they're all, you're like doing this to get to them or trying to catch them in flight, as we talked about. So, but no, it's an exciting time here. You know, I watch the migration maps online and see where they are and how they're coming. And I'm amazed, you know, spring's a little more spread out. But the fall migration, I'm amazed when I look at those migration maps. They say, oh, okay, well, we've estimated there's, you know, 28 million birds in the air. I'm like, my goodness, there are a lot of them, aren't they?
It's astonishing. I hate going to work for a couple of weeks in March. I'm like, I should be exempt. I need to be out in the woods.
Yeah, exactly. I'm with you. So I have a couple of things that keep me busy during a day, especially when a nice day falls. For me, not Southern California, but from where I am, where nice days are premium in the spring and you happen to be tied up indoors, you're like, this just isn't fair.
Really, it's painful. It's just painful.
So
I never thought about the leaves and what an impact they would have on your photography. Do you have a favorite season? Because there are different birds every season, but you can't see them in July. So what's your favorite season to
Well, I think spring up until about mid June, it's still sparse enough. Mid May to mid June, it's a great photography time. One, you got nesting going on, and you've got fledglings out and about. The grasses haven't grown up in the grasslands where I go. That gets head high by the time you get to July, August. That's more sparse. The leaves aren't as fully grown in. You got fledglings around. That's pretty much the sweet spot for birding here for the ones that are local. That's for sure. And then August, September gets pretty quiet around here. The babies are raised. The parents are kicking back. You know, couples are taking a little break from each other.
Right. Everyone's just kind of at it.
Everyone's just kind of, you know, gearing up for either the big flight south or the winter, fattening up for the winter. But all the real activity here really kind of starts is really March through, mid-June, I'd say, is when we have a total flurry of activity.
So you're almost there. You just got to hang on a few more weeks. Spring will come.
A few more. Baseball will get here and birds at the same time. I'm ready.
That's a good season.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, member of the Screen Actors Guild. Yeah. Nothing you've said so far has connected to that in any way. So you got to tell us your story.
Okay. Well, let's see.
Famous actor Harrison Ford in disguise.
Okay. No, that's it. Well, I tell you what. The whole story starts with I went out to LA on a vacation and met a girl, and all stories are interesting that start that way. So
so true.
So anyway, I met somebody. She had been actress and a model for a very long time in LA, and we got together. We ended up getting married, and she got me kind of interested in the acting world. And I had never even been in a school play, so I had no training. I had nothing. I'm in my mid 40s. I show up in LA, no training, no credits, and you can imagine what that's like to walk out. And I just walked out and went there and said, "Hey, everybody, I'm an actor." And I took improv. I took acting classes. I did all the things you're supposed to do. Next thing you know, I started getting some auditions, got an agent, started working a little bit. I kind of had the choice of doing very small parts and big things or having bigger parts and small things. And I kind of chose the latter. So a lot of independent film, some things where I got to actually do some acting and not be, you know, concerned onlooker number four, you know.
Not even number two.
Not even number four. But it was a good experience for me. And I really think that I I'm still doing a little of it here. Not much. It's just pretty much something that has to land in my lap. I'll go do it. Occasional commercial and did it. And actually what's interesting is one of the more interesting films I did that actually got the most traction, I did when I moved back here. A couple filmmakers in Indiana, Batesville, Indiana, who put together something for the 48-hour film project. And they asked me if I would come be the lone actor in their film, and I did it. And it went around the globe. So, a couple good ones in there. But I enjoyed it. I really wish I would have done improv early in my business career. I think improv is such good training for thinking on your feet. My father used to smoke a pipe, and he said it was a great, great advantage in business because he could think before he talked. think what he was going to say before he said it. And that was very good. I think that would have been excellent business training. Is basic improv training. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was a great time, but something I never saw myself doing. You could call it a detour, but it was just another life experience. I stay a member of SAG just in case project rolls through town. There's a few feature films that shoot here. I just kind of keep a toe in the water.
That's so fun.
It
is. We'll be looking for you on the big screen.
That's it.
Well, Stu, where can people connect with you, find your work, buy your photos if they want to, because they don't exist unless you print them. It's true.
Well, I guess you're gonna put a link in.
Yes.
I understand. But it's stumcleayphoto.myportfolio.com. And it's just we talked about bird photography, but I do other types of photography as well. I do some commercial photography. I do art design for various music interests. A lot of bands I do work with. I actually toured with ZZ Top for a while, so that's another story.
That's awesome.
It's been an interesting ride, I can tell you that.
You've got a lot of mileage under your tires.
Yeah, and I do portraits, headshots, modeling portfolios, and things like that. But anyway, that's all on the website. You can take a look. If you're interested in prints, there's a way to reach me there. You can also follow me on Twitter, I guess, X, whatever you want to call it. It's Stu McClay. You can follow me there. Also on Instagram, Stu McClay Photo. I'm not as active in Instagram as I once was, but you can see some of my work there. But you can reach me through any of those ways. And yeah, and happy if you see any prints, I can do any size. And as long as the photo will crop to the size that you want. And anything above billboard size, I have to send out.
Fair enough. Okay. We're just going to put up cardinals all over Southern California. Cardinal billboard. No ad, that's just it. Beautiful cardinals. Look that's at the cardinals. It. it might cause world peace. You never know. Beauty can save the world.
It can.
Well, Stu, thank you so much for the gift of your time and your photography tutorial for beginners and just the beauty that you're sending out into the world.
Well, thank you, Courtney, and thank you for what you do. This is an awesome podcast. I love listening to you and your guests, and I love reading your tweets. So, yeah, we'll stay connected that way.
And
good luck to your listeners. If they know how to reach me, if they've got questions.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You bet. Take care. Bye.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What is it going on your soul? Yes, it does.